Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion titled Transformative Religious Experience and Empathy for Future Selves. Our speaker is L.A. Paul, professor of philosophy and cognitive science at Yale University. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Institute for Philosophy and Religion director David Eckel.
Our speaker tonight is Professor L.A. Paul, a professor of philosophy and cognitive science at Yale. Professor Paul's recent work focuses on developing the philosophical concept of transformative experience. That's really the core of our seminar this semester, and a concept that has achieved considerable prominence in philosophical circles, but you can also see how it would relate to so many of the other traditions of reflection, religion, psychology, cognitive science, theology, whatever that might be, that all of us represent in one way or another. So she's been concerned with the concept of transformative experience, which concerns the nature of life-defining experiences, epistemic changes, and major life decisions. In 2014, she won a Guggenheim Fellowship for her research and her 2013 book on causation, A User's Guide. That book won the annual book prize of the American Philosophical Association. Her 2014 book, Transformative Experience, this is the book that we read in the seminar last week and enjoyed greatly. It was a topic of a very lively discussion. This was named by Cass Sunstein of Bloomberg View, and a lot more can be said about Cass Sunstein than he's associated merely with Bloomberg View. But anyway, in Bloomberg View, he called it one of the year's most important books on human bias and blunders. And I think the seminar would say that that was not a blunder to say that it was an important book. If you're with me, I'll keep moving here. Her work has also been covered in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and other important publications. And it has been explored artistically in The Missing Shade of You, a dance and spoken word performance by the Logos Dance Collective, performed in New York City in 2017. She is currently working on a book about self-construction, transformative experience, humility, and fear of mental corruption. She'll be talking to us tonight on transformative religious experience and empathy for future selves. Please join me in welcoming Professor Paul.
Thanks very much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here. And what I'm going to talk to you about today is part of its material that stems from discussions I've been having about the book in 2014 on transformative experience, and some of it is material that is part of my new book, the book that that I'm working on. Okay, so we use our imagination and our memory to prospectively assess choices. Okay, I'll say more about what that means. And by extension, right, we use our imagination to try to understand who we are and who we want to become. And that's my topic today. Okay? And in particular, I'm going to discuss how we can feel alienated in certain kinds of contexts from our future selves or from merely possible selves when we're trying to imaginatively consider the possibility of radical, epistemic, and personal change. So I've recently argued that there's a problem with relying on your imaginative capacities to envision possibilities for your future self in contexts of transformative change. So the thought is that if you face a transformative decision, that is a decision involving a choice to undergo an experience that may transform you both epistemically and personally, right, that you can lack a distinctive kind of epistemic access, a distinctive kind of imaginative access to some or all of the relevant possible selves under consideration. Okay, so a transformative choice is a choice of whether to undergo an experience that's both epistemically and personally transformative. What do I mean by that? Well, an epistemically transformative experience is an experience that teaches you something that you couldn't have learned without having that kind of experience. So Say that you were congenitally blind and then suddenly gained ordinary vision, or you were colorblind and put on a pair of enchroma glasses and were suddenly able to see red and green and maybe other colors as well, depending on the type of colorblindness you had. The idea is that having that kind of experience teaches you something, okay? And one of the things it teaches you, or some of the things it teaches you, are how to, or gives you capacities, right, to imagine and recognize other instances of that color, to make certain kinds of comparisons. So it teaches you basically what it's like to have that experience, and that then enriches you epistemically. Now, the thought is that the kind of access that you get through having this experience philosophically is involves endowing you with a certain kind of ability through a distinctive mode of presentation, the presentation of experience, as opposed to, say, reading about something in a text. Okay, that's the epistemic side of things. Now, personal transformation, right, involves a distinctive kind of change in who you are. It changes you in some deep and personally fundamental way. For example, changing what you care about, changing how you think about yourself, changing some of your core personal preferences. It doesn't have to change everything, but it changes something that's kind of really important to how you understand yourself or who you are, the kind of person that you are. Now, the kinds of experiences in real life that are like this are having one's first child, or so I've argued, or being able to see for the first time, like the example that I just gave you. And the most interesting cases involve a kind of epistemic transformation that sort of constitutively is a personal transformation. Sometimes an epistemic transformation merely leads to a personal transformation, but I think the most interesting cases are where this profound epistemic shift really is a shift in who you are. Okay, now to understand this intuitively, I like to set the problem up with a fictional example, and in particular, my favorite example involves the possibility of becoming a vampire. Okay, so imagine, right, that you're touring a castle, let's say somewhere in Romania, you're down in the dungeons, and all of a sudden, Dracula appears. Okay, and he looks you up and down and says, "Oh, you look like my kind of human. I'm going to give you a one-time-only chance to become a vampire." He says, "Look, it would be fabulous, right, because with one swift, painless bite, just don't worry, right, you'll be permanently transformed, and you'll become elegant, a creature of the night, you'll look amazing in black, your skin will be flawless, you'll be a little bit brutal, but you'll have excellent taste, right? And overall, basically, you'll become a member of the undead and completely change your life." And then he says, "You know, it'll be wonderful. Take it from me." Okay. Well, you feel kind of amazed by this. And then he says, "Go back to your hotel room. Think about it. I will come to your room at midnight. Open the window if you decide to transform. And if you don't, leave this place and never come back." Okay. So, got a few hours to decide. You rush back to your hotel room. You call your mom. You start texting your friends, right? And you tell them about this amazing opportunity. And as you start, you know, telling people about this, they, after a while, especially as you go on and on, they say, "Well, look, actually, I've been meaning to tell you, I actually already am a vampire." Okay? And once you get over this, you know, it's like, "Mom, why didn't you tell me? You know, I thought we were close, right? Your best friend." So you know, you get over your surprise, and you start kind of questioning the people, well, the former people, that about their experience, right? And you ask them, like, "Look, what should I do? Should I do this?" And they say, "Oh, you know, it is incredibly cool." You know, they tell you about all the great things. You have these amazing new sensory experiences. You have amazing powers you didn't have before. And they also sort of admit that, well, you can't go out into the sun anymore. You have to sleep in a coffin. So there are negatives. You have to drink blood. You think blood tastes really fabulous. They tell you this is actually great. You're maybe not so sure. But after you kind of go back and forth for a while, right, it just gets to a point where a number of them say, "Look, you just can't understand what it's like to be a vampire until you actually have that experience." Right? It's an amazing thing, they say. Like, it's like nothing I've ever done before. It's changed my life permanently. I heartily advise you to do it, but you simply can't understand what it's like until you become a vampire. So just take it from me. Do it. Okay, so that's the testimony that you get, and then you have a few hours to decide. And the question is, in this context, right, as you're reflecting and trying to figure out what you want to do, that there's an essential and incredibly important element of the evidence, right, that you don't have. In other words, or the possible evidence. And that is because, by definition, you can't know what it's like to become a vampire, right? There's an important and deep sense in which you're not able to make the decision in the most natural way in which you want to make that decision. In other words, right, if you can't possibly know what it's like to become a vampire before you try it, and you can't possibly know what you're missing if you don't, because the only way you can know what it's like to be a vampire is to become one, and it's an irreversible choice because it's not like you can go back and forth. You do it and you're done, right? Then how are you supposed to make the decision? And in particular, how are you supposed to make the decision in a rational way? In other words, in an informed way where you know what you're getting yourself into. You can understand the model that you're using, assign value to that future possible experience, compare it to other future possible experiences as if you decided not to become a vampire, and make a comparison and choose the thing that's best for you. The suggestion is that you're actually in a very difficult position because you can't perform the right kind of assessment and comparison because you don't know what it's like to be a vampire. So you don't really know what you need to know about your options. Okay, so that's the kind of transformative decision that I'm interested in. Well, except for I want real-life ones instead of becoming vampires. I live in a church in New Haven. This wasn't intentional. It was intentional. I meant to move in there, but this wasn't like connected to being becoming a vampire. But I do want to say that it is a little bit sketchy at this point, right? So the church was hit by lightning 10 years ago, and now it's deconsecrated. I'm not a vampire, but circumstances are a little bit suspicious, so, okay. Okay, so the real-life case that I like is the choice of whether or not to become a parent for the first time. Okay, I think that can function as a real-life version of a transformative decision that you have to confront, at least in ordinary cases and in contemporary times where we have a lot of choice about this matter, and I'm going to assume, let's say, if you're talking about physically producing a child, that you have the capacity for that, so I will assume there's a certain kind of modern context here. And in that modern context, the context that we're often in now today, we can be confronted with a transformative decision. And in particular, in often an ordinary situation, if you're a woman who physically produces a child, well, you go through a distinctive and unique experience when growing, carrying, and giving birth to a child. In the process, you form a very distinctive and particular kind of attachment to the actual newborn that you produce. Okay. And the way that you experience this relationship with your child, that is the way you experience standing in this distinctive parent-child attachment relation, will itself be an epistemically and personally transformative discovery. Okay. And the thought is that this discovery, right, involves coming into contact with a new kind of experience, not merely an experience, right? It's an experience of a certain distinctive kind of parental love. and until you actually stand in that loving attachment relation, that identity-defining relation, as psychologists describe it, you can't know what it's like. Just like falling in love for the first time, romantic love is a distinctive kind of experience that until you've actually been in love, you can hear about it and people can tell you about it, but you don't know what it's like until you actually fall in love. Okay. Now, the thought is that when you're kind of contemplating the possibility of becoming a parent, you're in a situation that's analogous to the situation you're in when you're thinking about becoming a vampire. Because in particular, right, if it really is a transformative experience and something that you can't know until you're actually in it, I think it is. I've done some collaborative work with people empirically about this as well. you're in a situation where it's an irreversible choice. Once you become a parent, you're always a parent, no matter what. No matter what happens to that child, I have two children. You're always a parent, okay? It's irreversible in a very salient sense. It's also the case that if you choose not to become a parent, there's a way in which you can't know what you're missing, right? And so basically you're damned if you do, damned if you don't, okay? I want to be clear that I'm not denying that there aren't lots of things that you can know about becoming a parent, right? You can know that life will be harder in some ways. You can babysit, you can get testimony from friends and relatives, you can look at the contemporary psychological research about whether or not it's going to improve your happiness. Interestingly, that research is kind of all over the place. It's quite mixed, depends a lot on individual circumstances. The point, though, is that knowing all of that, all that testimony, practicing changing diapers, carrying around a sandbag, whatever it is you're supposed to do, reading the psychological literature, isn't enough. And that's because the way that you experience the life-changing attachment to your child defines the ways that you experience and value many of the other things that involve, that parenting involves. Okay. Again, it's not that it's just about the experience. It's rather that having the experience kind of unlocks and changes the nature of a whole bunch of other kinds of activities that you engage with. And the character of all of these experiences change your preferences. In particular, the kind of thing that it changes is who you value most. There's a very deep kind of sense, I think, of self-preservation that when you attach to a child kind of goes out the window. You're willing to kind of sacrifice your life for somebody else in a very distinctive and basic way. Okay, so the thought is that until you've actually stood in this life-defining attachment relation, you can't know what the nature of your lived experience as a parent will be, okay? And that means that if that's important to you, if you think it's important to actually know what it's going to be like to be a parent before you become one, or if you think that if you're not sure and you're trying to evaluate the possibilities, so you think, well, would I enjoy it? Would it be something good? Is it going to be something valuable? What would it be like? If you can't know that, it seems like one of the essential elements of making a rational decision is absent. So the thought is there's a sense in which you lack the ability to project forward and assess the future self that you're considering becoming. Okay? Okay. And so the problem is, basically, that even if there are might be other ways to try to kind of fill in parts of the model, right, that you're confronted with this possibility of having to make a decision where you can't know in a very salient way what you're getting yourself into. Now, in the book, I argued that you couldn't make the decision rationally, and we can talk about that. But what I'm going to focus on here is on the other side of it, because what I really said was like, look, you can't make the decision rationally and authentically. You can't be informed in the way that you want to be informed when you make the decision if you try to make it in the ordinary way, namely by projecting yourself forward, kind of like if you're thinking about, well, do I want to have Fruit Loops for breakfast or do I want to have oatmeal? So you kind of think about, well, do I like Fruit Loops? Yeah, I kind of like Fruit Loops. Do I like oatmeal? Yeah, that's way better than Fruit Loops, so you pick the oatmeal, okay? You can't do the more substantive version of that in a transformative context, because you can't actually assess the nature of the experience in the way that you want to. Okay, so if the choice is framed this way, right? If it's framed in terms of prospectively forecasting or prefiguring the possible life that you're considering living, right? Then, in an important sense, you can't choose knowledgeably in an authentic way. That's what I'm really concerned about. Okay, now, when I've been talking about this, I've been also talking about a certain kind of, when I talk about authenticity and about prospective assessment, right? There's actually a related issue with respect to the value gaps here. And the related issue is that when you can't simulate your future in the right way, right, it's not only that you face this kind of decision problem, but there's another kind of issue involved, and that is what I describe as a kind of epistemic alienation. You're sort of alienated from the possibility, psychologically. Okay. Now, maybe it's not that big of a deal when we're talking about colors or Fruit Loops or something like that, but it can be a really big deal when you're thinking about who you might become. Okay. In other words, when we're thinking about life-defining decisions, about making ourselves into a certain kind of person, right? We want to be able to choose prospectively. That's a technical term. I've used it a couple of times. In other words, we want to kind of imaginatively try to see forward, to see from the inside who will be. And we do this by trying to think about or imagining or simulating a first-person point of view in that new context. So David Bellman has a nice way of describing this. This is the quote that I pulled out from one of his papers. He says, the future me, when you're trying to do this, whose existence matters to me, is picked out precisely by his owning a point of view into which I'm attempting to project my representations of the future. Just as a past me can be picked out by his having owned the point of view from which I've recovered representations of the past. So if you think about what you did this morning, there's a way in which you first personally project yourself back into what you were doing there. You can also do it third personally. If you think about yourself in the distant past, you might have a representation of yourself as though you were looking at yourself. Okay, there are two different ways we can do this. But it can be quite important when you're thinking about a life-changing situation. If you want to, know what it's like from the inside, so you try to do that first-person perspective assessment. Now, you don't have to do things this way. You can choose in a context where you just kind of ignore what it's going to be like for you to live that life. And sometimes people do just ignore that. Or sometimes they make the choice based on other grounds. So maybe there's a moral reason or a legal reason why you have to make that choice. Or maybe there's kind of social pressure to make a choice. And so you don't attend to what it's going to be like for you. But in other kinds of contexts where there is no kind of defining social, moral, legal obligation, what it's going to be like for us matters, okay? And we try to assess what it's going to be like when we make our choice. And in fact, it can be quite important in contexts where the decision is hard. And I sometimes discuss this when I say, look, if the world is carved up in a way that makes it easy for you, where you're not really having to give up something that's difficult, then maybe you don't have to worry so much about prospectively assessing things. But if the choice involves a trade-off where you're going to lose something important by taking that option, but you're also hoping to gain something important, that's when we often care, and especially if it's a forced choice where that's the case on either side of the options. That's where we try to prospectively assess, because we care about the nature and character of our future life, and if we're going to give something up, we want the nature and character of that life to still feel meaningful and valuable, like we made the right choice. So I sometimes describe this as a kind of prospective act where we try to try on the shoes of possible future selves. So there's another dimension of this as well, which is that when we can prospectively kind of try on those shoes, there's a way in which we can kind of make that self our own. And that's going to be related to what I'm going to talk about in a minute about sort of alienation and authenticity, okay? So if there's a way you can imagine yourself into even someone else's perspective, right, there's a way in which you can connect and understand them. And if you can't imagine yourself into someone else's perspective, there's a way in which you kind of can't understand them. And the real issue is that you don't want to find yourself in that position with respect to your own self. It's bad enough when it's another person. It's even worse when you find yourself in that situation for you. Okay, so what I'm talking about here is that we don't want to find ourselves in a situation where we're alienated from possible future selves, especially possible selves that we're deciding to make ourselves into. And this is really the problem, right? When you're thinking about, for example, wanting to have a baby, you want to have this kind of psychological access, right? All right. So let me see if I can kind of develop this a little bit so you can see what I mean when I say that transformative decisions raise the possibility that you might be kind of psychologically alienated from relevant possible future selves when you're thinking about making a big decision. Now, let's go back to the case where you're thinking about whether or not to become a parent, where you're when you're deciding whether or not you want to have, like, your first child, right? So you've never had a child before. And let's say that, well, you think about it hard, and after a little while, you decide, no, I don't think I want to do it, right? You just think, I'm not going to be happier as a parent. Mm-mm. Seems like I'm going to pass on that. Okay, so you make this assessment, and then after a little while, it turns out that Google builds a computer, okay, with expert judgment, and its name is Hal, and for a small fee and giving them all of your personal data for the rest of your life, you can actually get Google's computer to tell you which option is going to make you happier, having a child or not having a child. Okay, so what... For any future possibility, Hal can tell you what your utilities will be and magically kind of fill the value gap, right? Write in all the answers for you. So you consult Hal, and even though you decided that you didn't want to have a baby, Hal tells you that you will receive a very high utility if you have a child, okay? And as you live your life going forward, if you don't have a child, you can expect to have a much lower utility, okay? So as a result, right? If you choose to have a child, you will maximize your expected utility, right? And even maybe it's not clear about how much, but it's very clear that if you want to maximize your expected utility, you should choose to become a parent. Now, you can't understand this because as far as you're concerned, when you think about it to the extent that you can, you think, well, no, this just isn't something that I want. I don't know. It just doesn't seem like you look at these haggard people on the playground with, like, vomit on their shirt, and, you know, they talk about how they never have any time, and you think, why would I want to be like that? I don't understand this. I mean, obviously, some people find this meaningful, but it doesn't seem appealing to me. Okay. Now, the problem is, right, Hal knows what your utilities are, so Hal can tell you what the rational choice is, right? The rational choice is to maximize your expected utility. So the rational choice is to choose to have a child. So now you find yourself in a situation, right, where you had decided you don't want to have a child, but the rational expert tells you that you should have a child. So this kind of cuts against you, right? And if you decide to do it, there's a sense in which you are rationally alienated from your choice. You're alienated from the life that you're choosing for yourself before you actually kind of leap into that life. Now, once we find ourselves in this situation, I think this is where it's important, I think, to really understand the nature of the epistemic and personal change that transformative decisions or transformative experiences involve. Because if you don't think about this in a deeper way, it seems like there's a simple interpretation about what's going on with hell. Maybe you just don't know what's good for you, okay? Or maybe you really do prefer to have a child. It's just that you somehow are kind of in denial, or it's a preference that's going to be revealed when you have the child. Or maybe there's some kind of cognitive dissonance going on, okay? And in fact, this sometimes does seem to be the implication. If you are a person who doesn't want to have children, and then people kind of say, well, you really should, or, you know, they kind of look at you in this knowing way, and they think, oh, you kind of missed out because you didn't have a child. This is definitely a situation that I think some people have found themselves in. And I think that we have to be very careful here about how we're thinking about this structure. And in particular, right, by definition, when we're talking about undergoing a transformative experience, it's an experience that changes who you are, okay? And this means that if you decide to become a parent, if you actually then become a parent, who you are is going to change. But this means if who you are is going to change, right, the type of person you are going to change, what you care about most is going to change, then what Hal is telling you is not necessarily that you, who you are now, will be happier as a parent. What Hal is telling you is that the self that replaces you, if you become a parent, will be happy and satisfied. And that, in a very fundamental way, changes the explanation for this decision. So what I'm saying here is that when you get kind of post hoc or post experience data from an expert, whether that's social and behavioral evidence or whether that's Hal or whatever it is, right? It's testimony, basically, from people who've become parents. Even if it's a longitudinal study where they get testimony from people before they become parents and afterwards, right? It's not distinguishing between a utility value that represents your future self at T2 and a utility value, like, in other words, your future self now, so who you are now, but somehow extended forward into this later time, and a utility value that represents a psychologically alien self that replaced you. Aliens come in and just kind of replace you with a duplicate, right? But one that just loves being a parent. So the technical issue is that act-state independence is violated in this context. And what that means is ordinarily when we look at something and we kind of tweak something, like we tweak, you say, oh, I'm going to treat you for some condition and I'm going to see if you're kind of counterfactual, if you're better, and make a counterfactual assessment. If I hadn't treated you well, then you wouldn't have gotten better. That's a very simple relationship there. Right? And we use those kinds of relationships all the time when we're assessing data and looking at treatment outcomes. But in that context, we assume that everything else that's relevant stays the same. And that's why you get information about what the treatment did. Well, you're basically the same in all other respects, and when we treat you, that one property changes, so we get the right kind of dependence. But in this context, who you are is not independent of the way that you're being treated, of the treatment, namely of becoming a parent. So the act that you perform changes the state that you're in, and so there's act-state dependence. And that means the ordinary interpretation of the results is up for grabs, okay? So the way to interpret this in the context of the example that I was giving, right, is let's say you don't want to become a parent, but all your friends are telling you, they've all had kids, and they're telling you, oh, you'll be so happy afterwards, or Hal is telling you, you'll be happy afterwards. And you can say, look, actually what I'm worried about here is not about whether the person or the self that replaces me will be happy, right? I'm trying to figure out if I want to be who I am now, or if I want to replace myself. That's what's relevant. Right? So the decision isn't the straight and simple one, right? It's rather a decision about whether or not you want to replace yourself. And remember, in this context, we have a problem because there's an epistemic wall between who you are now and who you might become if you undergo the change. This also relates to another, I think, interesting debate in the philosophy literature, and that is the discussion of incommensurable theory change in scientific revolutions. If you're familiar with Thomas Kuhn's views about scientific revolution and how when you undergo a revolution, let's say from being a physicist who endorses Newtonian mechanics to being a physicist who endorses quantum mechanics, the problem can be that there's one way of thinking about the nature of the external world, and it's fundamentally in conflict with this other way of thinking about the nature of the external world. And the problem is there's no kind of theory-independent way to make sense of the world. So, there are related problems. Another issue is, just how do you shift from having one worldview to another worldview? But the point that I'm trying to make here is that just like there's no theory-independent way of understanding the physics, okay, you can't kind of step back and both believe Newtonian mechanics and believe quantum mechanics because they conflict. There's a way in which you can't, in any kind of theory-independent way or self-independent way, understand what it's like to be a parent and also understand for you to be a parent and also understand what it would be like for you to have never been a parent at the same time. There's just no person-independent way of comparing yourself and understanding yourself across time. And that, I think, is an interesting kind of theoretical problem. And the thought is that just like we can understand the notion of incommensurable theory change across scientific revolutions, you can think of this individual level thing as a kind of incommensurability of the individual across times. So there's a way in which you undergo your kind of own internal worldview revolution across times if you transform. And again, there's a kind of incommensurability here that we've explored in a different kind of context. Okay, so let me just sum this up by saying that the point of what I've been going through here is partly just to kind of go through some of the structure of transformative experience, but also to draw our attention to how in ordinary contexts, in our ordinary world, which is full of choice, right, that there's this kind of modern picture of self-realization where you've got this kind of open field of possibilities to choose from and you have to kind of chart your path through this field and get there, you know, in maybe the most rational way, authentic way possible. And the way that you're supposed to do that, in a sense, is map forward, right? Like plot your course and choose your adventure in some way. And do it in an intentional way where you're intelligibly understanding who you're making yourself into. And my point is that I think that that assumes an awful lot, and for all the decisions that are most important to us, we actually can't do that in the way that we might have thought that we could, right? And so this changes, I think, the way that we have to think about how we live our lives, about how we think about responsibility and blame, how we think about authenticity, and how we think about rationality. Okay, now the second thing I want to get to involves an exploration of the way that we can be alienated from our possible selves, right? But how maybe we might want that kind of alienation. Okay, so what I've been spending time doing is talking about how we might be upset about being alienated from a possible self. And now I want to switch to the other side, where we would have the opportunity kind of to embrace or know a possible self, but we don't want to. Okay. And this involves the notion of religious transformation. But before I get there, let me just start by saying that recognize that experience in general can form and revise preferences. Right? Now that we have that in hand, think about the experience of empathy. Empathy is supposed to be connected with understanding the views of others, with moral judgment. It's supposed to be a desirable trait. It's been getting some press about maybe involving maybe not being good all the time because it can encourage bias. I'm not worried about that. In general, right, there's a notion of like if it's kind of cognitively rich and educated empathy, then it's important to be able to try to grasp the perspectives of others, try to stand in their shoes in some other way. Now, sometimes you can't possibly stand in the shoes of another person. They're just too different. But let's say that you have that possibility. Let's say you know enough to be able to do that, right? Well, if you're going to do that, The way to adopt the empathetic perspective is to try and view the world from the experienced perspective of the other, right? And how do we do that? Well, a very natural way of doing that is like cognitively modeling or imaginatively modeling their point of view, what it's like to be them. That is, normally, we think this is important and we sort of understand how to do it. The economist and Nobel laureate, John Harsanyi, for example, describes the basic intellectual operation for decision-making and also for social choice and social evaluation is as imaginative empathy. And he says, quote, "We're supposed to imagine ourselves to be in the shoes of another person and ask ourselves the question, if I were really now in his position and had his taste, his education, his social background, and his cultural values, his psychological makeup, then what now would be my preferences between various alternatives?" The thing that I want to suggest is that when we start thinking about epistemic transformation and personal transformation and questions about authenticity, we might decide that in certain kinds of contexts, it's actually rational to reject taking an empathetic stance. Again, not because there's some kind of bias or because we'd be confused, but actually it's just a kind of imaginative act that we don't want to do. Okay, why? Well, because maybe if you empathize, you lose a certain kind of control. And in particular, you might worry that by allowing yourself to imaginatively empathize with the perspective of another person, you might actually then lose control over your own thought in an important way. Why? Because the experience of grasping the nature of someone else's first-person perspective could change what you care about right now in a way that you don't want to sanction. That is, empathizing might corrupt you epistemically. So the idea is that sometimes you might be rationally motivated to avoid empathetically understanding another person's point of view because to stand in their shoes and really try on their perspective could open you to the possibility of what I describe as preference capture. It could be, in virtue of having that empathetic experience, transformative. Okay? And if right now, ex ante as opposed to ex post, right? In other words, now before you've had that experience, right? You don't want to have your preferences changed in that way. Now, actually, interestingly, this is a certain possibility that's sort of described, has been described by anthropologists living in the societies that they study, right? Or you can kind of get a sense of how you might be in this situation if you think about empathizing, for example, in an understanding way with the perspective of a terrorist, right? Like, even if you had the imaginative capacity to fully empathize with someone like with a terrorist, how or where do you draw the line, right? How fully can you allow yourself to occupy the perspective of somebody who you regard as fundamentally evil in order to empathize and try to understand them? Because if it involves the possibility of losing control of your original perspective as a result. That is, if you truly empathize with the point of view of the terrorist, you might start to see the plausibility of his evil views and become evil yourself. Okay, so this is the risk. Or you might think maybe the same kind of thing comes up when you try to empathize with someone who's insane, right? If you truly allowed yourself, let's say that, you know, you didn't, I think that for a lot of people, you know, your grip on kind of reality and rationality can be pretty firm sometimes, but under conditions of like stress and duress, I think all of us can waver to some point, right? And if you really want to empathize with someone who's clinically insane, you might have to actually risk the loss of your rational faculties because maybe you couldn't get them back, right, if you wanted to empathetically understand them, to really understand them. And those are kind of speculative examples. Well, not that speculative, especially one with the terrorist. But if you're looking for something even more familiar, think about trying to empathize with the perspective of somebody who's a member of a cult. Okay? So, sorry, I forgot about Bill. I get involved and then I forget to move my slides. So this is like, Bill's like, look, empathy's important. Okay, but you know who we're to now? Now we're to Manson. Okay, like, what if you want to empathize with Charles Manson to really understand why he did what he did, right? So it could be quite risky. So I think a certain kind of fear of this kind of mental corruption exists, okay? And so I think we need to explore it a little bit more deeply. And in particular, I think we should explore it because we need to be more critical about this assumption that empathetic assessment is super important in contexts of like social choice and for arguments involving tolerance and for judgments that we make, in particular moral judgments of other people. Okay. Now, the examples I've been giving are examples where we try to empathize with another person. But you probably know what's coming down the pike, which is, look, you know, we think about these questions with respect to thinking about other people and understanding other people. But what's really salient in contexts of transformation is the issues as they arise for contemplating possibilities for our other possible selves. And in particular, I think that a fear of preference capture can arise when you're regarding the perspectives and possibilities of your own possible future selves. We can think of our desire to first personally grasp our future perspectives, which I was talking about in the first part of my talk, right, as a kind of desire to share a certain sort of empathetic connection to other possible selves of us, of ours. After all, if you might become that future self, you want to know and understand his or her perspective as fully as possible, right? Now, the first thing I was talking about today was that we could be alienated in an important way from these possible selves. But the second possibility is that you might actually desire such alienation. That is, you might fear empathetically understanding some of your future possible selves, really putting yourself in the shoes of a possible self, right, of who you might become, because putting yourself in those shoes, really kind of grasping that perspective, might actually drive you to become more like a self that you don't actually want to become. Okay? It might somehow lessen the counterfactual distance between you and that possible self who you reject in some way. Okay, maybe you find that possible self repugnant. Maybe there's something about yourself that you really just don't want to encourage. Okay. Now, understand this, it's always good to look at a possible case. Okay. And what I want to do for the last bit, right, is explore how this can come up in debates about religious transformation. So let's think about a standoff, a certain kind of standoff between a skeptic and a believer with respect to belief in God. Okay? So our believer exults in the rich satisfaction of his faith, right? In the revelation that attends to the experience of opening his or her mind to God. Okay? So this belief in God isn't arrived at by rational deliberation or by some kind of Pascalian wager. Rather, it's a kind of generous exercise of his capacity to grasp the divine majesty of a supreme being. Now, the skeptic, on the other side of the question, has no such desire, no such experience. He doesn't see any physical evidence for the existence of God, and he reasons that if there were a God, there would be some evidence, okay? And then concludes that the believer is really just kind of indulging in a kind of psychological need for comfort. Now, the skeptic doesn't begrudge the believer for having this need, but he takes the believer's approach to be an exercise in self-deception. Okay? So from his perspective, the skeptic's perspective, he's the clearer thinker. In the cold, hard light of day, he reasons to the most likely conclusion. He's rational, attends to the evidence, makes his decision the way that one is supposed to. Right? Now, the believer, when confronted with this kind of reasoning, right, argues that the skeptic has missed the point. In order to be properly receptive to the evidence, to be able to detect the evidence, you have to first be open to it. So, what's the believer saying? Well, to properly assess the case for and against belief, the skeptic needs to open his mind to the possibility of the divine. And then, once he's opened his mind, if he detects evidence, right, that's relevant, he'll be able to make his assessment. And the skeptic responds by refusing to do any such thing. And there, I think, we have an interesting impasse. And especially because refusing to see the perspective of the other side, refusing to fully participate, for example, in activities involving worship or opening one's mind to God, right, smacks of a kind of intolerance and even a kind of irrationality, right? Because if the skeptic really wants to assess in an unbiased way both sides of the question, he shouldn't refuse to engage in this way. It seems like it's the skeptic who's actually engaging in self-deception, not the believer. Okay. What this is a kind of impasse, and I think that you do see this impasse. And I think in particular, this impasse suggests there's something deeper going on. And I think we should notice that religious experience of conversion is just the sort of transformative experience that can radically revise you epistemically and personally. If that's right, then if having a religious experience is transformative, then these issues about alien perspectives and preferences can come to the fore. Okay, they can be involved. So I think, in particular, we can understand the skeptic's response as a kind of aversion or fear of preference capture. The skeptic fears that if he truly imagined or engaged with the perspective of the believer, it could change his judgment. Okay, now he's not afraid, like in the first instance, of he'll get new evidence, right? He's afraid that having a religious experience will change the very fundamental structure of his thought. It will change the way he responds to and engages with the external world, with what constitutes evidence. Okay, now. If you're interested, I think it's worth thinking about. What the background is of people in the room, but if you're interested in some of these theological issues, you might be reminded of Calvinism in particular. John Calvin famously defended the existence of a quasi-perceptual faculty, the sensus divinitatis. The sensus divinitatis is the sense of the divine, and it involves one's capacity, according to Calvin, to know God. And it's supposed to have a kind of cognitive quasi-perceptual component. When it's exercised, and only when it's exercised, will you then be able to grasp the divine. Alvin Plantinga, following Jonathan Edwards, who is kind of the U.S. Protestant defender of the sensus divinitatis, describes sensing the divine in this context as analogous to experiencing the world in other sensory ways. And his examples are seeing red for the first time. Jonathan Edwards said, it's like tasting honey for the first time. The thought is that the exercise of the sensus divinitatis, right, involves the ability or involves experiencing the moral qualities of God. And then the thought is that once you have this experience and engage with the divine, you're very naturally and intuitively moved to faith, okay? It's not hypnosis, it's not being drugged, it's not mind control in the ways that we think about mind control. So on a picture where manifesting your capacity to engage with the divine leads you naturally to belief in God, we can understand the skeptic differently. The skeptic, right, is not resisting hearing about evidence, right? He's resisting any future that involves the real possibility of becoming someone who isn't currently a candidate self for him. Okay? So it's fear, right, of losing your connection to who you are now, and let's say who your past selves are, right, and becoming a future self that's alien to who you are, that's involved in this impasse. Okay, so this is a better model for what's going on, right? The skeptic isn't just defending the status quo and isn't merely just resisting change for change's sake. Instead, he's confronted with the argument that to truly and fairly assess the value of believing in God, he needs to open his mind and experience and engage his sensus divinitatis, right? And of course, mere descriptions of this fall short. You have to actually have the experience in order to evaluate it. But the trouble is that if he's deliberating over whether to allow himself to have that experience, to open his mind this way, right, then he can't actually, if he's never had that experience before, cognitively model how he'll respond to the experience in the right way before he's had it. He simply has to have it, right? But once he's had it, well, then he's all in, because then what happens is he faces an epistemic and personal transformation. So the question for the skeptic isn't about, looking at the evidence. And by the way, this works mutatis mutandis for the believer, right? It's not a question about evidence in the first instance. It's rather a question about whether you're going to open your mind in a certain way, okay? Whether you're going to do this without having a certain kind of control, because by definition you don't have a certain kind of control. And the problem is then, the decision involves a decision of whether to allow yourself, whether to like open your mind to a certain kind of risk, where you could lose control of your preferences and become someone, you might become someone who's psychologically alien to who you are now. In particular, each person on each side of the divide, the skeptic and the believer, have to risk becoming someone who thinks very differently about the fundamental nature of the world, right, and who evaluates experience very differently from how they evaluate it now. And so they're being asked to open their mind to the possibility of becoming someone who is psychologically alien to who they are now. The thought is that when you look at the impasse between the skeptic and the believer, we can understand it a little bit like the person who doesn't want to have children but is being told by all the parents around them how happy they would be if they had children, right? On both the side of the skeptic and the side of the believer, the question is much more about the kind of person that you want to be and how you think you would understand the nature of the world or understand the nature of yourself, as opposed to some simple and straightforward assessment of the evidence and making a rational choice on that basis. The kind of closing thing that I want to draw your attention to is that the project then is to bring kind of contemporary analytic philosophy and I think lots of issues involving decision theory, epistemology, psychology, and imagination into contact with religious experience in the Christian world. And you can see this if you recall that it was Eve who angered God by tasting the forbidden fruit from the tree of knowledge, right? And so now when we start to remember this theme, right, we can see that there's this connection between the fear of experience and the corruption of faith, right, represented by Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, to this kind of counterpart fear of experience and intellectual corruption on the side of the skeptic, right, giving us a route from contemporary issues in philosophy and cognitive science and decision theory to some of the oldest themes of religious experience, knowledge, and discovery in Western culture. Thanks.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by L.A. Paul, professor of philosophy and cognitive science at Yale University. Professor Paul's lecture was titled Transformative Religious Experience and Empathy for Future Selves and was presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion. Tonight's moderator was Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. It's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.